Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America and all the ships at sea. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett in for George Norrie, who's taking a Friday night off, well deserved. I'm going to dispense with the usual Friday night frivolities at the beginning of the show. Yes, we will do open lines in 2 hours, but on Friday nights, we have some regular features, some benchmark things we do. We talk to Tim Banal about news of the week, and there's some great stories up on the website tonight. And we talk about, perhaps interview guests in the opening news segment, which we'll touch on something that's going on outside in the real world. But not tonight. I'm kind of throwing everything out so that I can get to John Douglas as fast as possible. He's given us a couple of hours, and I want to make the most of it. The new book is called The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators with the FBI's Original Mindhunter. John Douglas has written many New York Times best-selling books. Mindhunter, of course, was also made into a very successful Netflix series. Season 2 is on the way. And John Douglas has been the archetype of various characters in TV shows and movies over the last couple of years because he was so formative. He himself was responsible in no small part for the success of the criminal profiling unit of the FBI before becoming an accomplished author and speaker. He was originally a veteran of the Air Force, but he's been involved with more than 5,000 violent crime cases over the past 48 years. And as he discusses in the new book, The Killer Across the Table, most of the success of that had to do with conversations. For John Douglas, it started with conversations with bank robbers. When he was originally signed to a unit, fresh out of the academy, and he was in Detroit, he would talk to bank robbers, and he started to learn, like, why did they choose this bank over the other bank? Why this time of day versus 3 hours later? Why banks as opposed to, say, grocery stores? I mean, all of the stuff that helped to be able to profile and be able to, in some ways, anticipate the moves of a typical bank robber, so much so that they would develop a profile of the of who might be the next victim of a bank robbery, right? So, I mean, it isn't always about the killer, but it's always about the mind of the criminal, and that was the template that he had going into creating the unit, helping to create the unit that has been involved with the investigation and the apprehension of serial killers across America and around the world for years. I am reminded of a conversation that I had with Anne Rule when I interviewed her for my dissertation. When I went back to get my PhD, and as I mentioned before, it had to do with true crime. And she said once that she knows that she is often accused of being kind of a ghoul for having written about serial killers and their victims. But she said of the dozens of women and men that she wrote about who had been the victims of killers, she believed that all of that was far outweighed by the number of people that she prevented from being killed. Armed with the information that she was able to provide in her books about serial killers, helped to thwart or at least to provide the necessary ammunition for a victim to avoid falling into the hands of a predator. And I believe her, and I believe that John Douglas has done the same thing. And in this titanic battle that exists in our world between good and evil, I think he's one of the good guys. And you'll start talking to him, too, coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. In for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. I want to do right by you, John Douglas, and make sure that there's plenty of plugs for the new book, The Killer Across the Table, because we could talk for 2 hours easily about anything you've ever done. And so I just want to make sure we get that one in there because I know your publicist. It's a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much for giving us the time tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. And for the intro, you got me down pat.
Good. I hope so. You deserve that. And it was interesting because even your title, The Killer Across the Table, evoked Anne Rule and her famous book about Ted Bundy, The Stranger Beside Me. Did you have a chance to know Annie?
Oh, yeah. Anne was great. I knew her when she just really started getting going and met her at conferences just before she started becoming this prolific author, and she was a great woman. And
this is back when she would have been writing for the true crime magazines, back when she was a mom raising I think it was four kids, and she had to make her own way, so she was selling articles to True Detective, and doing well with that. But it was interesting because you make many of the same, not that you're copying her in any way, but it's that you or that she copied you, but you come to a lot of the same conclusions. And as I wrote this book about true crime and its role in our culture and why we need it and what it replaced in our mindscape. And I think that your work with true crime has been something that few authors could ever make as much of a claim to, in that you've been boots on the ground right there, talking to the very people that other authors could only dream of getting a few minutes of. You've spent a lot of time across the table with them. And in your book, you go through some cases that are equally fascinating to the better known cases, but aren't as well known.
Right. And plus, I had the credentials, the FBI credentials, that could get me into those prisons. Which, if you don't have them, it's a lot more
right.
difficult. And when I went into the prisons, I didn't have to, tell anyone in advance who I wanted to speak to. If I want to interview Manson, I just go into the prison. I may talk to the warden, say I want to talk to Charles Manson. What about? I'm not going to tell you exactly what the specifics are. I would tell them. And then they would, they bring whoever I wanted to speak to out for the interview, and I would spend 4, 5, 6 hours with them, at a time. But I did this. I did this really out of survival. When I came back to the FBI Academy, I was only 32 years of age. I was recruited out of the Air Force at 25 years of age, which was very, very young. Went back to the FBI, then went on to Detroit. Like you mentioned at the top of the hour, where I worked bank robberies, I worked organized crime cases, worked with the homicide detectives, then went on to Milwaukee, and then came back to the FBI and would audit the senior instructors. And the only trouble was the senior instructors, they were telling war stories, but they had never really done any research. So they'd be up in front of a class talking about, for example, like Ed Kemper. And there'd be a guy in class who would say, hey, I worked the case, man. You got your facts wrong. So I'm sitting in the back of the class auditing this instructor, and I'm saying, oh, my goodness. I said, I cannot. I may be a young guy, but I got to accelerate my learning. And so when we go out, we call them road schools in those days for 2 weeks at a time.
Road schools. Yeah, that's interesting.
And I would then we'd teach for, say, in L.A., for 5 days, but you have all this spare time, downtime. Let's go into San Quentin. Let's see if Manson will talk to us. Let's see whomever will speak to us. And we didn't ask for any bureau permission because, sure, they would have said no. And because when we did get caught doing this, the bureau, just like in the Mindhunter series, they weren't too keen on this. Like, why are you talking to these people? What's the purpose here? Our job is to investigate and lock them up. What? The purpose is, I'm trying to understand the criminal personality of the why plus how equals who.
Right.
And here, when we have an unsub case, we're trying to figure out the who. Here we have people who are incarcerated. We know who they are. I'm trying to find out the motivation, why they did it, victimology, why they selected a particular victim, why they did the things that they did to the victim. What was the pre-offense behavior? What was the post-offense behavior? If they confess, what was the circumstances surrounding the interrogation that made this person volunteer and provide provide information to the police. So began doing that, and then teamed up with Dr. Ann Burgess from Boston College, who we developed this 57-page computerized instrument, a protocol that would cover every aspect of the case, the victim to the subject, every you name it, but it'd be every piece of the an investigation. And unlike in the show, where the investigators go in, and my character is portraying my part, goes in with a tape recorder and notes, I would never do that. I never had a tape recorder, and I started off with one with Ed Kemper, and it was a mistake because they're extremely paranoid individuals. You know, what are you doing with the tape recorder? Why are you taking notes? And so I abandoned that, and then what I would do, I would just memorize the case backwards and forwards, memorize the protocol, 57 pages, some of which I could fill out before I did the actual interview, the rest I could fill out after the interview, and then conduct the interview. And it was just surprising how open they began they were with me. And it wasn't interrogation. They didn't teach this kind of stuff in training at law enforcement academies or the FBI, because it was not an interrogation. It was not like an interview. It was conversation, and they had just as many questions for me as I had for them. They wanted to know about the Bureau. They wanted to know about, how I do the work that I do. And it started off, we would receive maybe the first year, I received 50 cases from police who had taken my classes at Quantico. And then it started doubling and doubling every year after that. So by the time I retired from the Bureau, I was doing 1,000 cases, and I had 12 agents working for me, and we were just swamped. Many of us were just so burned out because of the volume of the work, the nature of the work, and many of us along the way got sick, physically sick, emotionally sick from this type of work, and dealing not just with the subjects, but dealing with the victims and the surviving victims, the families who want answers, who want to know what happened to their daughter. What was it like for my daughter when she was being murdered? And they want you to describe. They want you to describe to them everything that took place during the crime, which is gut wrenching. And at first, I said I don't want to do that. I don't want to. And they would get angry with me.
Sure.
And then finally, I had to open up, and I had to go through. You had to go through the case with them, and explain to them and everything about about the case. So it was emotionally draining to do. And to this day, I still do it.
But you have to, in a way, because at a time like that, when we have been victimized, what people don't want, I think, and this comes from more from not from my research in true crime, but because I went to seminary and I'm ordained in the Episcopal Church,
right,
is that people at a time of crisis like that, they want facts, they want truth, they want someone to say things to them that are not platitudinal. You know, they don't need to hear God needed another little ballerina in heaven,
right?
They don't need that. What they need is somebody to just talk straight to them. And that's what they were demanding of you, because you had the information and they have the imagination, and maybe their imaginations were worse than what it was that you could tell them about what happened. And it helps them not just fixate on that and go around in circles.
Right. In fact, in the current book, The Killer Across the Table, there is a case in there, Joseph McGowan.
Yeah, fascinating.
A little 7-year-old child was murdered by a school teacher who lived in the neighborhood. She was collecting money from the sale of Girl Scout cookies. And the mother, Rosemarie D'Alessandro, I became very, very close with her, and helped her in her fund, and she's changed the laws in New Jersey, because the person who I would be going and interviewing was all set to get out of prison after serving the maximum sentence of 30 years. And the interview that I did, the parole board swore me in, and I was representing the parole board this on this particular day. And went into this interview environment. I staged the interview environment. I had very low lighting. The room was dark. The room was cold. Very little furniture. You know, in the room. I didn't want him in shackles. Big guy, 6 foot. He was about my height, 6'2", but strong. He got real strong since he's been incarcerated, working out in the yard with the weights. And it was just fascinating. At some point, what you're trying to do is you're trying to take him back to that day, the 30 years earlier, right. And turn on that CD in his brain, where I got him back, and now let's see if he has been so-called rehabilitated. That's why I was there. Will this person be a threat to society if he's released? Because he's going to get out unless someone thinks that he should stay in. And so I conducted this interview, and into the interview, he just started looking off. As I said, what was it like that day? It was Easter time. What was it like? And why did you do the things that you did? I try to ignore words like child or murder. And he was a school teacher. He got demoted in his school job. He was engaged. The engagement was broken off. He was living with his mother in the basement. His mother was away at work. His grandmother was upstairs. The school also, the teachers went away on vacation, did not invite him. And then all of a sudden, he just looks at me, and he turns away, and he says, "When I heard the knock on the door, John, and looked up and saw her, I knew I was going to kill her." And this was a little 7-year-old girl. And then, "What did you do, Joe?" And then he talks about how he lured her down into the basement because he said he didn't have any money. The money was down in the basement. But what was amazing to me at the time, I was freezing in the cell with him. It was cold. He is sweating and shaking at the same time. His pecs under his shirt are just trembling to me. And he's going through all of the details. And at some point, he begins to whisper to me because he doesn't want anyone to know what he's telling me. And he's forgetting that I'm representing the parole board. And I said, "When you get out," I'm telling him not when he gets out. I'm saying, "When you get out, Joe, where are you going?" And he says, "I'm going to New York." I said, "Man," I said, "I was raised in New York. It's expensive." And he says, "I got money." "You got money? What do you get money? Making license plates?" He said, "No." He said, "I got money from the insurance when my mother died, my grandmother died, money from the sale of the house. But I put the money out of state." "Well, why'd you do that?" "So the victim's family can't get any of the money." And then I said, well, man," I said, you'll do great when you get to New York." I said, "How much you got?" $650,000. "Oh, you'll be living high on the hog when you get to New York." Well, little does he know, maybe he does know, the next day I'm going before the parole board.
Sure.
And I'm going to be presenting this stuff to the parole board. And when I do, they're shocked. They're shocked at the information, how I was able to get the information. And to me, it was very, very simple. And why is it simple? Because I told them, I said, "Because you guys rely on self-reporting. You don't look at the crime scene photographs. You don't look at the autopsy protocol, the autopsy photographs. You don't know anything about the police investigation at all. So you really believe when this guy tells you that he doesn't get the urge anymore to kill, you really believe that he's telling you the truth? You really believe that? Because they lie. Don't you understand? These people lie to you, and they'll test you to see whether or not you understand their case or know the case. And one of the things that McGowan would later do, because the parole board later told me, is that he wrote to some woman, one of these crazy women that fall in love with these guys, and said, "You know, I was interviewed by this guy, FBI guy, John Douglas, and I noticed during the interview, he didn't have any notes, and he wasn't taking notes, he didn't have any papers, but he knew my case. He knew my case backwards and forwards." And that was something that evolved with me over the years that helped me to get information from out of these people and to develop this kind of a feigned empathy or concern for the person who I'm talking to, where deep down I'm kind of fighting myself, thinking, "Oh my God, this guy here, if anything, should be executed."
Right.
And here I'm his great buddy.
Well, that's so interesting, and it brings us to the bottom of the hour, and I don't want to get too deep into any other story because I'd only have to stop, but This speaks directly to something that that you wrote in chapter 10. Again, the new book we're talking about with John Douglas is The Killer Across the Table. And this quote stuck with me because of something that always bugs me whenever we talk about the line between good and evil. And I'll get back to that in a second. But here's the quote. He was talking about just that same thing, interviewing these people who were killers. And he said, "The many times I've faced off against killers who would have been just as happy to murder me as to talk to me have been among the most intense experiences of my life. Just as happy to murder me as talk to me." That's where we'll start when we come back with John Douglas. It's Friday night. We will do open lines later on, but I'm enjoying this conversation. I hope you are too. In for George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. A little Tom Petty, the song that was what Catherine Martin was singing, the character in Silence of the Lambs, the victim who ends up in that that cistern in the basement, saved later on by Jodie Foster's character, Clarice Starling. That was in service of Jack Crawford, which was based on John Douglas, who was our guest tonight. But the way that she was singing and happy and coming home from work and had groceries, and the victim, in this case the fictional victim, actually follows the same pattern of real victims of serial killers. And in that case, it was Ted Levine's character, that great James Gum, sort of ambiguously named serial killer, who was using the tools of our human nature, right, against us. We want to. We're always sort of feeling like we should be helping people more, and he did that thing, which, you know, if you remember from the movie, he had a cast on his arm and he was trying to carry a sofa and stick it in the back of his van, and he looked like a guy down on his luck. And it was that cast on his arm thing, of course, that should remind us all of Ted Bundy's little trick that also disarmed the victims, that also lured the flies into the web. And that's just what happened in The Killer Across the Table, Unlocking the Secrets of Serial Killers and Predators, with the FBI's original Mindhunter. John Douglas was talking about the story of Joseph McGowan, and I want to get back to that and explore just that flip, just that twist, just that moment between order and chaos, and then how we must all put the world back together again afterward. On Coast to Coast AM, in for George Norrie, this is Ian Punnett. So, John Douglas, the Mindhunter, both of the book and Netflix series fame, as well as the Silence of the Lambs series, is here with us, and we're talking about some of the lesser known, or at least, you know, certainly in New Jersey, regionally, a lot of well-known cases, but not quite the marquee names of BTK or Ted Bundy that he talks about in The Killer Across the Table. It's more about the conversations themselves and what the process of conversation reveals, and what people are willing to reveal about themselves. And this brings us back to the Joseph McGowan case of a school teacher, high school chemistry teacher, who creeped out some of the girl students, was always trying to be liked, but kind of always failing at that at the same time. So coming to the bottom of the hour, John, you mentioned that he had said to you later on that the second he saw the victim who came to the door, little Joan DeLisandro, right? That he, when the second he saw the girl, he knew he was going to kill her, is what he mentioned to you. But in his original confession, at least according to the book, that was a snap decision that came after he knew he needed to molest her. He was overcome by this sort of sexual desire for her. And then after he did that, then he knew he had to kill her in order to hide the evidence. You get the conflict I'm mentioning there?
Yeah, the parole board, when they went before the parole board the very next day to tell them about the interview, they were referring to him as a pedophile. And I said, I said, the girl, yeah, she's 7 years of age, but he's not a pedophile. He's, what are you talking about? He's not a pedophile. On that particular day, when he heard the knock on the door, there was a 7-year-old girl at the door. It could have been a 70-year-old woman at the door. He was in the mode to kill. And there's of course, there's a sexual component to it. But one of the things we found in the research, or I did particularly early on, where there may be evidence of sex, but when you conduct the interviews and when you start putting it all together, it's really, it's about power, it's about control, it's about displaced anger. And it really, they may have a preferential victim, a certain age, a certain look to a victim, but if they can't find the victim, they'll kill whomever is available there. So yes, there was a sexual, you know, component. He failed during the sexual assault. He had her stripped down, as you know, from the book, which got him
right.
Angry, prematurely ejaculated, and then now he went through all the gory details of how he killed her, where he went to dispose of her up in a park right near the New Jersey border. How he inserted himself into the search parties, looking,
right.
You know, looking for the victim, which is very, very typical. We would look for that today because we've seen so many cases, like that. But see, he
well,
was.
That,
you, yeah, go ahead, sir.
Well, that just no. That I was going to say. So right there at that moment. So let me jump in to say,
yeah.
that's what brought me back to some of the themes in the book because, mm-hmm. as you said, you know that you would just. You could see this guy as being execution worthy in that sense. You didn't see anything redeeming about letting him out and letting him back in and letting him have access to this money, and that it would only create there would only be future victims. And that's what I was reminded, as I said, something J.K. Rowling once said when she was talking about Harry Potter. And it just always bugged me because I just don't think there's any evidence for her saying this. But she said, there is no good and evil. There is only power, to your point.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are those too weak to seek it. And I thought, that's just not true. There is true evil that lurks in the hearts of some men and women.
Oh, no, you know, that definitely isn't. And the concern with McGowan, with the parole board, would he kill again? And I said, because they're telling me what a model prisoner he is. And I said, well, he should be a model prisoner. I mean, he's here, and he's getting his three square meals a day. And,
right.
and so he stayed out of trouble. But now you put him back into, you could go to New York, you put him in that situation there, stress, something doesn't go go right for him. It may not be the same type of case. It may be a workplace violence or some other type, type of crime. But he has this within him, and it's you cannot rehabilitate someone who is not habilitated to begin with. I mean, he's been like this for his
right.
entire life. He had some of the earlier signs of bullying as a child. Animal cruelty we saw, which is a theme we see in a lot of these different cases. Animal torturing, which is a pretty good predictor. At least if you see that, or a school teacher sees this, a parent, you better address it and not think that it's something that the child is going to grow out of this bad behavior. But no, he certainly was evil. So the end result with him is they gave him a hit. They call it another 30 years, but he's not going to serve another 30. He could get out earlier, but I doubt it. He'll probably die in prison, and I hope he does die in prison and not get out. At least because he does get out, I'm going to be one of the guys he wants to see because
right.
I kept him in prison.
Yeah, and with a, if I can say this, I mean, I think we all felt it while you were recounting the story, with kind of a, and I use the word loosely here, but sort of a legitimate gripe about betrayal. He confessed to you on things that you,
yeah.
you know, in a very jujitsu-like way, turned around against him the next day, and so he had to feel like, damn it, you know, that was a moment of like, I can't believe I did that. And I gave the ammunition to the guy who used it against me. I'll get that John Douglas someday. And I could totally see that's the way he would feel.
Yeah, because sometimes during the interview, I'm thinking, this guy, he's telling me stuff that no one even knows about, even other cases, not just him. I'm talking about other people. I'm just trying to create an environment where they forget who I am, forget, you know, where they are, make it a kind of as relaxed as I can type of environment. Where I've had some interviews where I actually interviewed a half a dozen killers. I used to go over to Baltimore, and they would bring in about a half a dozen, and they would sit around, and I would sit around with them and go through the crimes with them. And some of them, I would tell them, I said, I'm really at a disadvantage. Just kind of tell me what the crime scene would look like and what the elements there. And then I would kind of go through it about who they are and what led up to the crime and what was the precipitating factor or stressor, what they did afterwards. And they'd sit around here and they're amazed, like you think they're some kind of psychic or something. But it's just you see so many of these cases. And the thing that's frightening is that there's no remorse. Because over the crimes that they perpetrated, not in the least. And I'll get them sometimes crying, but the times I've got them to cry, 60 Minutes actually followed me into Pittsburgh Penitentiary. You mentioned Silence of the Lambs and Ted Levine, who I met, because I was a technical advisor in the movie. I was in the bureau. I interviewed the guy who kept women in the pit. His name was Gary Heidnik in Philadelphia. I don't know if you ever heard of him, Ian. But the difference with him is he would fill a pit up with water and put the victim in the pit, handcuffed, shackled, and then he would get an electric wire and electrocute them while they were in the water. And then he did horrific things, after that. But when I did the interview, and Leslie Stahl, it was one of her first shows that she did for 60 Minutes. She about freaked out when she was observing me with this interview. The time it really got to him is when I brought up the mother of forget the victim. He didn't care about the victims. It was his mother relationship or the lack of relationship that he had from a mother who pretty much abandoned him. But there was some abuse involved, both emotional abuse, sexual abuse by boyfriends that came home with the
mom.
And that, yeah. And so that was the thing. And I found that with so many other cases. I mean, I interviewed a guy named Bittaker. His nickname was Pliers Bittaker, and a convicted rapist out of California. And these two guys fantasize when they're in prison, when they get out, to go to rape a teenager for every year of a teenager's life. And they got a van called the Murder Mac, insulated the interior, cruised L.A. They killed a half a dozen. And what made it horrific is that they made audio tapes of the torture before they killed the victims. In fact, I made Scott Glenn, who portrayed me in Silence of the Lambs, I made him listen to. I said, I want you to know what the heck we go through down here, what we see. We want to see what kind of evil that is out there. And during the interview with him, I had a woman agent next to me. She would ask a question. He wouldn't even look at her. Not that he would not kill her. He'd kill her if he had the chance. He didn't want anything to do with her. So she'd ask a question. He'd look at me. And the only time he got emotional was when I brought up, again, early childhood, mother, lack of
abandonment. Yeah.
And then they got emotional. But as far as emotional for the crime, it's justifiable homicide in their way of thinking. They deserve it. I have my own problem. I'm here incarcerated. I'm locked up 24/7. There's nothing there. So when you get a psychologist going and doing an interview, and these guys, they know how to shed a tear. They know what the buzzwords, what the shrinks want to hear from them. So if you go in again, not armed with the facts of the case, the background, all the information there, and have that, but you may need somebody to interpret, because they don't necessarily have that background, interpret it for them, what it means. If you're making decisions, probation and parole, I told them, I said, you have no business making those decisions, because you really don't understand the crime or the criminal who you're talking to.
The book, again, is The Killer Across the Table. And in this book, John Douglas and his co-author, with whom he has worked for years, Mark Olshaker, talk about talking about. So it's a conversation about conversations, that this is how it's done, and this is the dynamics of these types of conversations that end up becoming essential to good police work. Well, there's this long-standing belief about that somehow we've entered into some sort of new age, and I know that because of cars and planes and the internet and other technology, of course, you know, it's easier for people to find more victims, or to find the perfect victim. It might have been, you know, you can, if they know just the kind of victim they're looking for, they might be able to create more circumstances using, you know, a chat room somewhere or something. But I'm of the belief, and I'd be curious if you think about it, because I included this in my dissertation about I wrote about narratives, about how true crime stories are told and what the role is of true crime in our culture. And I argue that it goes back to the same role that folk tales and fairy tales used to tell, which was the idea of something, of these stories were prophylactic in nature. They were intended to be preventative, and that you heard these stories and you heard them repeatedly so that you began to know who are the who are those that you need to avoid. And I think that's so much of what you did in your work in profiling. You were doing the same thing, is who are the people that we need, how do we help find out who the future victims and the future perpetrators are? But what do you think of that idea that the archetype for every serial killer today in some ways could be traced back to the earliest known versions of these stories, I think, in terms of folk tales and fairy tales? Do you see a legitimacy there?
I see some legitimacy there. The problem with the media and how the media portrays these offenders, they make them kind of supernatural. Some of the Hannibal Lecter types, and today through the social media, the internet, it's changed the MO, where you don't have to be necessarily cruising, looking for hitchhikers and looking for that victim. And you got a case because you're in Kansas, Ian, right? So you have to remember John Robinson?
Of course, yep.
John Robinson, who I wrote a book about that, Anyone You Want Me to Be, which is a good title, because it's like when you get on that internet and there, he was interacting with women in S&M sites, and they may be looking for certain things, and he would answer whatever they were looking for. He got it without even, just by exchanging emails, you know, back and forth. So now you get these characters. They can just throw out some lines and get some nibbles here. Yeah, we have the police. You know, they're trying to monitor, but they can't be, you know, everywhere monitoring every type of website there is. But there's still this kind of, you know, this kind of, and I think that's what made it crazy with Ted Bundy and the movie that's out right now and on Netflix. It's this kind of good-looking guy.
Well, Zac Efron. You're talking about the Zac Efron series, about the romance. And when he was incarcerated with the woman that he carried on and was able to get her pregnant and all this other stuff, right?
Right. And there's a lot of criticism with that because the actor is such a good-looking guy portraying Bundy, and I heard Zac Efron make a comment that it was the reason he got away with his crime because he was white privilege. No, it wasn't white privilege he got away. He got away with it because he was good-looking privilege. He was able to use that as part of how he was able to attract women to him. And then, as you know, because you mentioned it earlier about the MO that he used, he had the cast on the arm, or he'd be on crutches, or he dropped books outside of a library.
Right.
The victim, you know. And one thing that the movie did not show is they really didn't focus that, you know, that much on the victims and really what the victims went through with him. And that's when I conduct these interviews, I'm looking in the faces of these people, and I'm trying to imagine sometimes, okay, now this guy, I'm looking at this guy, and he looks real normal, his expression, but this is the face that the victim was looking at, and that this was not the kind of face or expression that the victim saw, or this kind of behavior that he's presenting to me. And sometimes it's hard to believe because my God, you think, you know, this guy here did these things to this victim, and he's acting it's kind of normal, and he just looks like the average Joe. Dennis Rader, you know, look at him.
Right.
Again, another one.
From the area, yeah.
Yeah, you got him. I did a lot of work with the KBI, great police force.
And, of course, we should mention In Cold Blood, too, if we're going to talk about it. That goes back to, about 4 hours from here, but yeah.
That's right, you got him. You got some big case. In Bordella, there was a case, too. It's newspaper boy, I think, some years ago. you know, too. So, yeah, but I think everyone has this that there's a look to them. There's not really a particular look, and they're not all geniuses. They're not all Hannibal Lecters.
No.
Some of the ones we've interviewed, the smartest guy was that definitely Ed Kemper, and then this guy in this current book, Todd Kohlheff, who I don't know if you're going to mention him later, Ian, but he's the guy had kept a woman in a container in South Carolina and rescued her. But he killed a total of seven people, and I was involved in one of the investigations where he killed four people in a motorcycle shop.
Well, hang on to that thought, because we'll get to the news here at the top of the hour, and then I do want to get to the Kemper case again a little bit more, as you mentioned, because of how the media has helped us to understand him. But I also want to ask you about a popular theory about the connection between CEOs of American companies and serial killers. John Douglas is our guest, the killer across the table, in for George Norrie on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Bonnett.